You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined in studio once again by our expert, Dr. Krishna McGovern. Good morning.
Kia ora.
Well, I guess good afternoon just passed. All right, so what have we got this week on science, in the world of science?
Well, I just realised just this morning that I managed to inadvertently do a bit of alliteration with the stories today. Bees, biofilms and borderlands. So we'll start with bees. So, common eastern bumblebee. It's a bumblebee that's, as the name would suggest, common, but in North America. And what it does over winter is all the worker bees and stuff, they die off, but the queen bee, she'll burrow into the ground and basically go through something called diapause. So it's a little bit like hibernation. She just stops developing, and it's a way to survive conditions that aren't great for the bumblebee. And so there was this PhD student, she was doing a project, and she's researching these bumblebees, and she's interested in how pesticides in the soil are maybe having an effect on these bumblebees in this diapause. And so what she had for her experiment, she has all these tubes that got a bit of soil in them, and they've each got a bumblebee, and she puts them in the fridge to simulate sort of winter environment. And then one day she just takes her bumblebees out with this thing called a hibernacle, which I thought was quite a cool name. And some of the bees have water. These tubes all have water in them. And so she's, as her words were, she freaked out, right? Because she thinks she's just killed her experiment. Only a small amount of her experiment, but she thinks she's killed some of them. So she takes them out of the tube and that puts them on the bench and lets them kind of dry out. And they're still alive. And this is like, she shocked. Like, she talked to a few people around her that have done a lot with bees, all these bumblebees, and no one had kind of seen this before. And so this led to her and her supervisor doing a bit more of an experiment and purposely submerging some of these bees. So they had a control group, which was just the bees on the soil, and then they had a group where put some water in, so they let the bees float. And then they had some where they actually put a plunger in, and so like they were pushing the bees under the water, and they let them sit for like 8 hours, 24 hours, and then 7 days, and then they would take them out, and then they would put them on some just dry soil again and leave them in the fridge and then see if they survived. And surprise, surprise, the ones that were totally submerged for 7 days, at 8 weeks after they took them out of the water, still like 81% of them were fine. They were alive. And so that this was not much of a reduction on the control group, which was about 88%. And so this is like, it's totally surprising to them. And so it has implications for like how much does flooding affect the survival of the species.
Right.
Yeah. But there's a lot of work. They don't really know why or how these bees are surviving these conditions. If it'll be all species of these bumblebees, what other sort of environmental effects? So if there's pesticide in the water, is that going to cause issues so that you get synergistic effects that are not necessarily good? And so, yeah, it was a really cool example of, oops, that was a mistake, leading to something that was, quite new.
I'm guessing we don't usually see bees swimming around in the wild.
I don't know too much about bees, but I always remember... As a kid, like, you were kind of told if you saw like a swarm of bees that you would hide under the water kind of thing. I guess it's not their natural environment. They're not going to go hunt it out. Like, they did say that in the wild, you do tend to see these bees will choose places to burrow that aren't in floodplains and stuff. But it is kind of nice to know that if they do get caught out and in a flood, that they might still survive.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then next up, I don't know, do we have borderlands or biofilm next, do you think?
We can do biofilm next.
All right.
So biofilm is, it's you know, that slimy stuff that you kind of get collects on your shower when you don't clean it for a while. It's basically a collection of microorganisms, so like basically mostly bacteria, and they've like excreted some stuff that kind of makes a slimy film. And you can imagine If you're underwater and you're trying to do like for like taking images, like photography, or you're trying to have video and stuff, and so you've got these glass windows that you're protecting your equipment through, if this biofilm grows over time, that's really not great, right? It's going to obscure your view. And so there's a lot of interest in how to stop this happening. If you were just on a surface like your kitchen bench or your implant that you get in your body, or you know, your surgical equipment and stuff, often what they'll do, or sometimes what they'll do, is they'll use UV light. And so they'll shine the light at the surface and you kill the bacteria.
Right.
But if you're underwater, it's not so easy, right? The water, you can be kind of murky, and so it attenuates this light. Also, if you want to do large areas, you need large light sources, which is not practical. And so what this group did, was what was really quite clever, is that they basically engineered the light to emit the UV itself across its whole surface. And so what they did is they were particularly interested in a region of light called UVC, which is the shorter wavelengths. So you're talking in around the 250 nanometers range, which means this is it's the best at killing the bacteria, basically. Right. And so they would take the glass, and then they, on the back of the glass surface, they put some silicon nanoparticles, which are about 250 microns in in diameter. And then they just put like a clear polymer surface over that. And then what they did is they still needed a UV light source, the LED, but instead of shining it at the flat surface, so the broad surface, they shone it at one of the edges. And so you've only got this small cross-section of the glass getting the light. And what it did is, with that light being injected into the glass, it then scatters around because of the nanoparticles. So those nanoparticles that they've put on the back of it don't absorb any of that light, but they cause all that light to scatter. So you can just think of the lights just like bouncing around like crazy in the glass surface. Some of it escapes, so it kind of has a bit of a UV glow. And because of this, it basically means the bacteria don't grow on that surface. So you're not having to use, usually you would have to put a chemical like a biocide, or you'd have to pattern the surface to make it non-stick, or something like that. But now they're not having to. They're just using the light. And what they found, if they put just glass and then their UV emitting glass into water for like 20 days and just off Florida, and they found like they had 98% reduction in biofilm formation. So it would work really well. And so now they've patented, and now they're going to try and work out how to make it better.
All right, and lastly here, what's going on with Borderlands 3 and DNA sequencing? What's the crossover here?
So this is, I'm not a gamer, so this was the first time I had learned that there was a Borderlands game series, and then I realised that I'd actually watched a trailer for it very recently. And this is a really cool example of what you call citizen science, where it's basically scientists trying to get the public to help them with their data crunching, but they've used gaming in a really fun way. Okay, so if you sequence DNA or RNA, so our genetic material, it's never done as the long chain that it is. It kind of gets broken up into small pieces, and you get these small bite-sized chunks. And what you have to do, or what scientists do in this area, is that you then have to order these bite-sized chunks, and they all kind of overlap a little bit, and you've got to see where the overlap is, and then you basically build up the long chain. So it's kind of a big puzzle. And obviously computers can do this, but they're not that great at it yet. Like, there's still a lot of mistakes pop in. And the other thing is what this project, what these scientists were specifically interested in, was not human DNA and that. They were actually interested in the gut microbiome. So you think of your human body, you'd think all your cells are yours. Actually, in your body, over half of the cells in your body are not your own, they're bacteria, right? If you just go on the number. And what it is you've got this microbiome that, you know, we often think of bacteria as bad, but they're not just bad. They do a lot of good as well. And so there's a lot of focus at the moment on developing and understanding the microbiome of our bodies, particularly the gut. But it's a real big challenge,
because you've got lots and lots of different types of bacteria. Depending on where you live and how you eat and all sorts of environmental factors, those things change. And so you've got this massive problem where you're going to generate massive amounts of data, and then you've got to process it somehow in a way that you can then go and use it. And so what these people did was they went, right, we need people to do basically pattern recognition on a large scale. We can't just use our students because we don't have enough. But there are a lot of gamers in the world, right? There are a lot of people who are using a lot of computational power and are really getting into, you know, their first-person shooter or their I can't remember the description of a Borderlands 3, looter shooter or something. How do we harness this power, kind of? And so these scientists, originally what they first did was they basically created kind of this pattern matching game, but it was very much focused on the science, and it was called Philo. And it didn't get a lot of engagement. Like, it got engagement, but they didn't get as much as they wanted, kind of. And so then they went to what I think it's called Gearhead Entertainment, who make the Borderlands game series, and they decided, okay, we can make this game, but we need to really focus on the game aspect of it, make it so that people enjoy it, so they'll engage with it. And so they made in the, now this is not from personal experience, this is very much from me reading about it, in the home base of the Borderlands 3, there's a little arcade game called Borderlands Science, and it's, instead of having AUCG, which is the nucleotides of the RNA, they made tiles that had referenced the game, and then so people could go and do this pattern matching, and they'd get some coins that they could then spend on stuff in the game, and so they're happy, and meanwhile, they're doing all this pattern matching that the scientists can then go away and use and create this massive database. And so they were saying, in half a day, I think it was, the people playing this game had done as much as what, or had, no, sorry, done five times as much as what the people that paid Philo over 10 years or something had done. Like, it was just massive. I think there was like 1 million, what were the numbers? It was launched in April 2020, and it's had 4 million participants, and they've contributed 135 million solutions to these multiple sequence alignments. And so now there's this massive data set that's all open access, so it can be shared around the world. There's no studies that I found yet that have come out from this data set, but they're kind of saying, right, we have this data set now. You can go and do your studies on microbial evolution. You can look to see how the microbes are affecting health, how it changes from this country to that country. And what's also really great is now that it can train the computer, the artificial intelligence that does this pattern matching, so that you don't necessarily have to rely on people in this large scale. And the other thing they're saying is because of the framework with which they put this game together, they can apply it to different science problems now. And so I think we may see a few more of these games pop up in these games like Borderlands 3. They do say, like, it's probably the sort of thing where it'll be institutes or open access people that are kind of pushing for them, because there is a bit of a cost associated with it. But it sounds like people engaged, they must have found it fun. So, yeah.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. Any people, fans of Borderlands or other video games, look forward to doing this scientific work as well in the future. Once again, thank you for coming in, Kushla. Thank you, Motat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.